This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
In the news and inside higher ed, there was an article on Brooke Harrington, who's kind of an economic sociologist, stratification type person, and she's looking at the super wealthy. And she's running into this little problem. Her job is as a business school professor in Denmark at Copenhagen Business School. And she's given several public lectures not directly attached to the university. So she's given friendly lectures at other Danish schools, and she's given a talk to the Danish parliament. And she's in trouble for this because it's considered work that is not listed on her visa. So she obviously has a work visa, being a foreigner in Denmark. But her work visa, like a lot of work visas, it says you're allowed in to work at this employer doing this job. And the Danish immigration authorities are treating this as if she was basically moonlighting, driving an Uber or something like that. Whereas, like, from my perspective, it's like, this is what university professors do. It's part of the job. And the article I read doesn't indicate whether she received an honorarium for giving these things. If she received no honorarium, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. If she did receive an honorarium, I could say, okay, this is a mix-up, you know, and I understand how she should have declined the honorarium or, you know, something like that, because that is technically, earning income. But if you're giving a lecture for free, that's not work, in my opinion, even if it's very similar to what you do at a job. I mean, I don't consider myself to have moonlit when I visited Duke a couple months ago to give a lecture.
Well, this would be moonlighting what we're doing right now. If unpaid work, unquote.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing a radio show. Yeah, you're right. And it's part of academic culture, right? That part of being a productive academic is visiting other schools and giving lectures at those schools. Sometimes there's an honorarium, sometimes there's not. I've done this a few dozen times. Most of the time there was no honorarium. A couple times there was a nominal honorarium. I don't want to sound ungrateful for it, but it was basically nominal.
It's like dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And typically they pay your expenses and that's it. The idea that like UCLA would be mad at me for going to visit these other schools and give talks is absurd. And the idea that like, I mean, I'm an American citizen, but even if I did this in say a Canadian school, I can't imagine Canada getting mad at me for giving a lecture at McGill or something.
Right.
I think the article does say that it doesn't matter if it's paid or unpaid, that just because it's outside of the scope of duties as defined by the work permit, something like that. So I had that same question about whether it mattered that if she got money for it, but it sounds like not. And the fact that it was at the parliament is,
Yeah, that's really weird, eh?
They invited her and then they said, oh, by the way, this is a criminal violation of your work visa. I mean, my question would be, I saw this article too, and just wondering, if the rules are, they're obviously, this affects all academics who have these similar types of work permits or visas. So I'm curious, I'm sympathetic to her because it does seem like if it's as it sounds, this rule seems ridiculous. It really is part of what you do as an academic to share your work. But obviously, others are under this constraint, and the fact that she's run into it, I'm not a conspiratorial thinker, but this idea that given her work, other people have wondered, what's going on here. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it is interesting.
Yeah, well, nobody told her work. Gabriel, can you go? Because I bet you the topic of her work.
She studies tax havens, basically. And
the Panama Papers also, like in specifically. And I know, of course, in America, it's barely made ripples because everybody's, so deferential to rich people. But in other countries, this has really triggered like major.
Well, also, there weren't
outrage.
That many Americans in the Panama Papers.
Do you know what they're doing? I heard they're doing in Canada. I'm going to say I'm 80% on this, but I remember hearing on the CBC what they're doing is they're triggering audits in the five wealthiest postal codes. Uh-huh. People whose incomes don't match the value of their home are going to be pulled in for audits. Yeah. And I thought, wow, if you did that in America, one, that would never happen in America. They'd be like, congratulations. Thank you for evading taxes.
Well, that does happen with criminal inquiries, right? So that's effectively what they're doing right now with Paul Manafort, where he has very little reported income. And like the Weekly Standard had some really good reporting about how he seems to have been laundering all this sketchy foreign income through rug salesmen, where he claimed to buy like $1 million worth of rugs from like, you know, Joe's Rugs and, you know, Fairfax, Virginia.
Cyprus.
And well, but he paid for it with a Cypriot bank statement. And then, but then it seems like he's presumably getting some type of kickback from the like maybe he's actually getting something to put on his floor, but he's not getting something to carpet a football field. You know, nor is he getting like something that was owned by the 14th Mughal emperor. He's just getting like a nice rug. And then he's presumably getting this money as a kickback somehow as a way to money launder it.
So I have a question. So like getting back to the papers, right? Yeah. You know, there may not have been a whole lot of American individuals, but it's my understanding that there were at least a few really big American corporations, right, that were outed, right? In these,
those were in the Paradise Papers.
Oh, that's right, the Paradise Papers. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about this newest iteration, right?
Yeah.
So, and in thinking about that, like, it got me thinking about this tax bill, right? This tax bill that like gives these tax cuts, these forever tax cuts to corporations, with this idea that, oh yeah, if you just lower the tax rate, then, you know, then corporations will just pay that tax, and that's that. And you're like, what? Like, why would they do that?
No, but that actually does make sense, because, you know, if you talk to economists who study this sort of thing, now there's some assumptions of that that are highly dubious. So the assumption that if you have increase in profits, that the incidence of that will go through wages. I would believe that if it was 30 years ago, but for the last decade or two, you've seen rising profits without pass through to wages.
But the
issue with taxes is that the way that you reduce tax evasion is that you lower the rate and you cut the loopholes. If you have a simple tax structure with a low rate but no loopholes, or, you know, if you want to call them deductions or whatever, then you get less tax evasion than if you have a high, you know, stated rate but tons of, you know, credits for this and, you know, depreciations for that. That's how you end up getting a lot of tax evasion.
I actually believe what we're going to find is that corporations are going to be paying, like, in terms of real dollar values, we're going to be seeing less money from corporations, and I think we're going to be seeing the same amount of offshoring, et cetera. This isn't going to matter, and we're not going to see, you know, that like reduction in taxes moving on to the worker
offshoring
at all.
Jobs or offshoring. I don't believe that like factories are going to come back based on what you did with the tax code, but I do believe that you're not going to stash your money in Ireland if the American corporate income tax is more comparable to that in other countries. You don't have an incentive to stash your money in Ireland.
You don't have to do that because you can stash your money in Delaware.
Yeah.
Now, right?
Well, Delaware still is the federal thing, right? I mean, Ireland, you know, attracts a lot of investment, at least on paper. And so, like, you have this absurdity that, you know, Apple claims to be, in some respects, an Irish company rather than a San Francisco Bay Area company because it has the lowest tax rates in Europe. But
like, as long as there's a place with super low rates, this thing, I'm sure they'll be, it's not as if they're going to cut tax rates and be like, well, now this is all done. Yeah. They're going to be like, now they're still too high. Let's cut them somewhere else. So they won't go.
And isn't it also true that historically when the U.S. has actually done this, like cut corporate tax rates significantly, then other countries just make the same move?
I don't know if that's true. I do know that, cutting the corporate tax rate is one of the few places where the Laffer curve does seem to apply. That like last time there was like a drop in the corporate tax rate, you did see a lot of repatriation of profits that had been parked overseas for a long time.
Well, we're in this new stage of capitalism. Let's see if that happens.
And I also propose that we have a new rule that whenever somebody says laffer curve, we change subjects.
Well, okay, listen. I generally don't believe it, right? And I generally think, I mean, in some ways it almost has to be true, but the question is, where's the maximum of the curve? And the answer to that question is not 30 or 40%. It's considerably higher, right? The maximum of the curve is somewhere between, I don't know, 50 and 90%. But it's not 30 or 40%. And there's no way that you can raise revenue by cutting the U.S. Federal income tax rate, because we're already well below the maximum of the curve.
Now that the Supreme Court has declared that corporations are people, do you think behavioral economists will start actually treating corporations more like people and look at their behavior?
Well... I mean, but we look at corporate behavior, but yeah, I get the joke, but I don't know. This issue of like being apoplectic at corporations being people. I mean, it's just a way to have corporations have access to legal rights, which I'd say is arguably a good thing, because otherwise how's the New York Times going to have First Amendment rights? The New York Times is a corporation.
Yeah, that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, sure.
That's for our political philosophy episode and legal philosophy.
Yeah, that's right, which none of us have expertise in.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.